on FM, programmed non-commercial radio, launched our podcast service, relaunched our website, have been the home of your favorite DJs. We've come a long way with limited resources, but we need your help to continue to grow. Call 604-822-8648 right now or visit www.citr.ca/donate to make a donation. Show your support for Campus Community Radio, CITR's Fun Drive, on now.
Hello, I am Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. From William Faulkner to Jimmy Santiago Baca, American writers continue to enlighten us with their novels and poetry. Writers who constantly spew out major works of fiction, decade after decade, some writing in the heat of the Mississippi South, others in the darkest of prison cells. A major theme in American literature is ethno-autobiography, the struggle for individual autonomy as well as community in relation to dominant narratives of the nation-state. What American Nobel laureate Toni Morrison writes in the opening lines of her new novel, Mercy. Don't be afraid. My telling can't hurt you in spite of what I've done. On today's show, we talk to two scholars of American literature, one who has unearthed literary gems from William Faulkner's 1935 novel, Pylon, bringing Faulkner back into our modern sense of time and place, and another who unearths hidden narratives within American prison writing, reminding us that, yes, some of the best writing has come out of prison walls. This is Prof Talk, radio that churns out the writer in all of us. On today's show, I interview Associate Professor Michael Zeitlin from the Department of English, who works primarily in the field of 20th century and contemporary American literature, with main interests in the novels of William Faulkner, Don DeLillo, and Cormac McCarthy, as well as in the history and theory of psychoanalysis and narrative representations of the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and the war in Iraq. I reach Professor Zeitlin in his office. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Farah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, your current research is about Faulkner, aviation, and the rise of European fascism. Can you give us a bit of sort of chronological background for your research?
Sure. I think in general, it's probably fair to say, this is a big generalization, but that Faulkner Studies has been interested in the history of the South and the history of race relations in the South. And in American culture in general. I think what I'm trying to do is to put Faulkner in a global context and to talk about world history and politics, and specifically the Great War, World War One. He tried to actually participate in it, and I can talk a little bit more about that if you like. Certainly in the 1920s and 30s, the rise of European fascism was something that he was noting along with everybody else, and was obsessed by the coming of the Second World War and then the full-blown emergence of the military-industrial complex during the Cold War. These were all things that he engaged in his fiction. So generally speaking, chronologically, I really want to talk about that. Mainly what the project I'm working on now is the period, you know, between the two wars, the two world wars.
Now, Faulkner's novel Pylon is at the center of your studies. What is Pylon about?
Pylon was published in 1935, and it's about the opening of a brand new airport in New Orleans, although Faulkner renames the site New Valois-Franciana, instead of New Orleans, Louisiana. He's interested in a kind of fictional and apocryphal representation of that event. It's one of his only novels that is set in a city and on the margins of a city, and it's set also explicitly beyond his famous Yakna-Potawa County, which was that region in North Mississippi that I mentioned before, where he lived and grew up in. So Pylon is a city novel, and it's about certainly the rise of technology and the arms race Specifically, what happens as they dedicate this brand new $4 million airport is they organize it around an air show, and they invite barnstormers from all over the country to congregate at the airport and to put on a show. And the show includes airplane racing around the pylons, hence the title, parachute jumping, aerial acrobatics, you know, rocket planes and that kind of thing. And there's a mob of people who come out to watch the events. And inevitably, there are crashes and there's spectacular deaths. There's massive newspaper coverage of these events. And the whole scene is narrated by the amplified voice of the announcer. So for me, I'm fascinated by Faulkner's vision. And for me, I think, and for Faulkner in 1934, 1935, the vision he has is of a modernity that is coming to resemble more and more the kinds of social and technological organizations that we're finding in Europe, specifically in fascist Germany and fascist Italy.
Can you describe again the airport a little more, and some of the words that he uses to describe what he sees actually himself, he witnesses in the airport, and of course he uses it as the airport as a motif in the novel Pylon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about the novel is it's strikingly experimental in its language and in its typographical effects. One of the first things one notices about the words is that they're often made up. I mean, he comes up with a whole bunch of neologisms, and it's very Joycean in that sense. So tight splattered, slant shimmered to describe the reflections off of plate glass and so on. And at the same time, in order to sort of give us a feel for the mass media coverage of the events, he'll every once in a while you'll turn a page and you'll see some bold type newspaper headlines, you know, right in the middle of the text, or sometimes even more interestingly, you'll see a fragment of a headline. For example, in one case, somebody has a newspaper folded in his pocket, and so all you can see is you know, one little piece of the headline, and he'll kind of reproduce the effect of seeing these things in the text. So it's a very experimental novel at the level of its language and at the level of its typographical effects. That you were asking a bit to describe a bit more about the airport. He's fascinated by the architecture of modernity, and he spends a long time, for example, describing the rotunda of the airport, the sort of the waiting room. And this is actually based on a real place, the Shushan Airport, named after Abraham Shushan. It's been renamed now the Lakefront Airport. And my understanding is, I haven't been down there recently, that it was damaged in Hurricane Katrina, but in the original rotunda, there were vast murals depicting famous scenes of aviation, including, you know, Charles Lindbergh's flight across the Atlantic in 1927, and various other, you know, heroic scenes. And these are elaborately described in the novel with a sense both of admiration and also, I think, irony.
Now, you connect this novel with Stanley Payne's A History of Fascism.
Yes.
And so can you pull that together, and especially in terms of, again, some of the descriptions of this sort of mass, like the crowds, the mass mobilization of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stanley Payne's History of Fascism is an utterly fascinating book, and he talks about the fascist movements all over the world in extraordinary detail and with great expertise. One of the things that he tries to show in the book is how large-scale transformations in technology and in the mass media were pressed into the service, you know, pressed into service by the fascist leaders to organize their, you know, their political movements. A famous case in point would be something like Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, in which she filmed the Nuremberg rallies, and everything was staged with a sense of how it would be represented on film. So you have the masses of people. You have, of course, the charismatic leader speaking into a microphone, and you have, you know, usually sort of seen from below and looking up at him and so on. And you have images of airplanes flying overhead in formation, and, of course, uniformed soldiers standing at rapt attention and giving him the Hitler salute and the new tanks, the new weapons, and everything else. And I think that, you know, Payne goes through each situation and talks about not only the history of fascism, but he points out those elements of a kind of fascist style that became really visible in that period and which were reflected in the mass media. And these were elements that I think Faulkner is attempting to engage in his own way with his novel Pylon and with some of the other stories and eventually Hollywood screenplays that he's involved in writing.
So would you say that Faulkner in a way almost prophesizes things that were going on in at the time, and also you know, in world history, if we look back and understand how you know, especially the invention the airplane and what it became in the World War?
Absolutely. I think that's central to my fascination with Faulkner in this novel in particular. Is it's full of it's a novel that's rich with premonitions, you know, about how things are going to play out, rich with prophetic visions. And I think what he sees is partly, you know, and this is something he writes about just about everywhere, is he, as a Southerner, he was very sensitive to the invasion of modernity into the South, you know, the transformation of the agrarian old South into a region that was going to be indistinguishable from every other region of America, you know, mass-produced goods and suburban housing developments and everybody beginning to speak in the same way, you know, with the hard R's and that kind of thing, which he also writes about in Pylon. But I think even more specifically, he gets a sense when he looks at airplanes how they're going to be, how important they're going to be in the arms race and how they're going to be transformed into killing machines. And you know, as a young man, he wanted to be a pilot and actually joined the Royal Air Force and trained in Canada as a pilot, although all the evidence seems to suggest that he never got a chance to fly because World War I ended before he had that chance. But he claimed always that he was a pilot and that he had had wartime experience. In fact, he claimed that he was shot down and walked around with a limp when he came home and claimed that he had a steel plate in his head and that kind of thing. And eventually in the 1930s, he did trained as a pilot and got his license and bought an airplane and the like. But for him, the airplane was a highly ambivalent thing. He was fascinated by airplanes and flew them, as I say, but airplanes also killed his brother and his best friend. In fact, the airplane that he owned, he gave to his younger brother, Dean, as a present. And on November 10th, 1935, a day before Remembrance Day, Dean crashed and died in the airplane. So for him, for Faulkner, the airplane was somehow central to these large-scale transformations of modern society, and he was highly ambivalent, to say the least, about these transformations.
Now, you've also mentioned Laurel de Bosses?
Yes, that's right. Laurel de Bosses.
De Bosses. Can you
that's how you pronounce it. Indeed.
Yeah, can you tell us about him?
Just an utterly fascinating figure. Basically, Laurel de Bosses was an Italian anti-fascist who, in 1931, hired an ex-German war pilot to train him how to fly. And after only 7 hours of solo experience, Laurel de Bosses flew over Rome and dropped almost 500,000 anti-fascist leaflets over the city and over places where he knew that Mussolini was hanging out at the time. It was an extraordinary thing to do, and the irony and poignancy of this scene is that as he attempted to fly back to Corsica, where he had started from, he ran out of gas and he crashed in the Mediterranean, and he disappeared, and he and his plane were never found. Even more interestingly, I think, is the fact that he was a playwright, and before this anti-fascist episode, he had written a play called Icarus, which is, of course, about, you know, the Greek myth of Daedalus and Icarus, and how Icarus flies too high and his wings melt and he crashes also into the ocean. I think I want to show in my work, among other things, that Laurel de Bosses was a significant figure for Faulkner as he began to think about the kinds of gestures people could make with an airplane, symbolic and political gestures. Certainly, there were the dominant models. Charles Lindbergh would be an example, or Italo Balbo, who was a captain in the Italian Air Force, who flew over the Atlantic with a squadron of seaplanes and landed in Chicago. But Faulkner was also interested in the sort of the Icarus gestures of pilots in that period, and in fact incorporates that gesture into Pylon. Basically, what happens to the central figure, Robert Schumann, is he's flying around the pylons, loses control of his airplane through no fault of his own. It's a faulty airplane. And instead of crashing into the grandstand full of people, he steers it out into the lake and vanishes. You know, his plane crashes and he disappears. So I think DeBossus becomes a central figure for Faulkner. And there's a lot more to be explored, I think, around DeBossus's history and biography.
Well, it's been great to speak with you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure, indeed.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our tragedy today is a general and universal physical fear, so long sustained by now that we can even bear it. There are no longer problems of the spirit. There is only the question, when will I be blown up? Because of this, the young man or woman writing today has forgotten the problems of the human heart in conflict with itself, which alone can make good writing, because only that is worth writing about, worth the agony and the sweat. He must learn them again. He must teach himself that the basis of all things is to be afraid, and teaching himself that, forget it forever, leaving no room in his workshop for anything but the old verities and truths of the heart, the old universal truths lacking which any story is ephemeral and doomed, love and honor and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice.
You have just heard an audio clip from William Faulkner's acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize in Literature, which he was awarded in 1949. At the time the speech was given, the world had just emerged from the Second World War. My next guest is Simon Rolston, who is a PhD candidate specializing in 20th century and contemporary American autobiography. He's interested in how autobiography can function both as social control and also as resistance. His dissertation, The Politics and Poetics of Self-Invention in 20th Century and Contemporary American Prison Writing, explores the conversion narrative as it is produced in the American prison system. He's a recipient of the Theodore E. Arnold Fellowship and currently holds a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council doctoral fellowship. Here's an audio clip from our conversation about his current research.
So my work is looking at the conversion narrative as it's articulated in the American prison system. And what I mean by that is the conversion narrative is a narrative of fall, you know, personal struggle, and then rebirth. That's traditionally been understood within, you know, Christian traditions. Not exclusively Christian, but that's generally how it's understood within an American context. Most usually known or associated with the Puritans and the Quakers and then so on from there. So what I'm interested in is how the American prison system, starting in 1776 when the first prison was created in Pennsylvania, was how this structure was basically built around a narrative, around the conversion narrative. So whereas before, punishment after crime was basically something that was punitive. It was enacted on the body, and that was its function. Then you have, with the prison, this notion that actually, through punishment, we can change people. You can convert people. The Puritans and the Quakers were the ones who were the best, you know, at writing those conversion narratives. And, of course, the Quakers and, to some degree, the Puritans or the children of the Puritans were the ones to develop the first prison systems. And so you have, in 1776, you have a system, this architectural system that's developed where, with the understanding that people will come in as criminals, as deviants, or what have you, and through a period of, at the time, it was basically solitary confinement, will then somehow emerge of the other side as citizens, as renewed people, as reborn people. So essentially the prison system from 1776 follows that line. And I'm interested in how that line develops, but the language in many ways stays the same. So you have from 1776 to 1870, and these periods are periods that I'm looking at that you know, could be debated in varying ways. But I would say from 1776 to 1870, you have this conversion narrative that's articulated in two different prison systems, one which is based around a solitary confinement format in Pennsylvania and its competitor in New York, and called the Auburn system, which was more of a congregate system where people were not in solitary confinement but were forced to do labor. But in both systems, basically the idea was that you would come in, you know, a criminal, but then you would leave transformed, you would leave a citizen, right? So after the Civil War, this narrative changes somewhat. I mean, it's I think in many ways the same narrative, but how it's framed is different. In 1870, you have this language of science coming in, and the idea of these people called the new penologists, who basically were saying that actually you could develop a science of how to change people from criminals to citizens. And I'd say that goes from about 1870 to 1950. It's a broad period, and there are many specific changes within these periods I'm outlining. But that's one of them. Extended out of that is from say 1950 to 1960, and like I said before, these dates are in many ways not arbitrary, but you could sort of draw these lines at other places. But what I'm interested in is the narrative change. So you have at around 1950 this change from the reform narrative to a rehabilitation narrative, and that's one we're probably all fairly familiar with, which is still a conversion narrative, I think. But it's focusing on this development of change and a rehabilitation through education, certainly, but also through medicine. There was an intervention of medicine and treatment, right? That's not just direct sort of surgery, although that actually happened in as early as the kind of reformative period. You had people doing lobotomies and some such business, which is fairly scary to think about, and medical tests that happened certainly up until the 70s and 80s. But the treatment portion was really a kind of psychological, sociological treatment that became all the rage in the American prison systems, particularly in its leader, which was in California. And that's an interesting period because at the same time that you have these very coercive ways of sort of defining how prisoners have to change before they're allowed to be let out of the prisons, you also have a massive development of prison writers. Because, of course, a lot of these prisons, not all of them, but a lot of them, were emphasizing education. And you had, you know, university profs coming into, you know, San Quentin, for example, and, you know, all fired up with, you know, a civil rights movement and interested in prisoners' rights and so on, and really, really working with prisoners in order to develop their own writerly skills, right? So you have a massive burgeoning of prison writing in really through the 60s and 70s. After that, you have a real backlash that's, I guess it's usually understood as happening around the 80s, late 70s, early 80s. There's a number of major moments like the Attica prison uprising, for example, which was where Attica prison was essentially shut down by the prisoners there, and they took hostages, and it ended up being a really bloody police intervention in the end. The prisoners had quite understandable demands, things like, you know, good food, proper care, human rights. But ultimately the police came in, and I think there was about 30 people who were murdered. So that was a real touchstone for that period. So what ended up happening is a backlash in the 80s, which focused on basically closing the doors. So much less on the rehabilitative element, much more focused on control. So prisoners became, you know, enmeshed in this system that was dependent on controlling them and in controlling also what they were writing and how that writing was disseminated. So that's in many ways where I think we are today. Of course, that extends out to Guantanamo Bay. It needs to be also understood within the same framework, I think. Guantanamo emerges out of and is not, you know, something separate from the development of the American, what people have called the prison industrial complex. So I think, and I think more work needs to be done in understanding those connections and understanding how at one point, and hopefully this is now changing, but at one point the American prison system and its coercive system, particularly that developed in the 1980s, was also being expanded internationally. And those prisons are still around. So even if Guantanamo closes, you know, you have rendition sites and other systems of control. So it's a troubling time right now for prisons, but it's one that also has a whole bunch of fascinating work and interventions that prisoners themselves have done. So that's where I'm locating my own research. Writing in prison is inescapably in prison, right? So writing is if it's determined by your conditions, then, you know, the prison system is the ultimate location where your written work is, you know, circumscribed by, you know, censorship, by the demands of other prisoners, by the demands of the prison system, and most clearly by the parole board. So if you're trying to write, you know, an autobiography, you have to take into account quite a vast and complicated audience when you're writing. So, you know, say, for example, you were to say, you know, to discuss, you know, something that you've done in the past, which might be a bit unsavory, you want to think about the fact that this is going to be vetted when it comes time to go before the parole board. And that has very serious consequences for you. It could lead you to being in prison for a very long time. Particularly with someone I'm looking at right now named James Carr. He's writing in California in the late 60s, early 70s. And he ultimately has to produce this kind of rehabilitation narrative, this conversion narrative, not in his writings, but in the way he lives, right? So basically, he has to spend a long period of time after you know, being in prison, essentially causing a lot of trouble, which was his really what he was up to, what he was into. But then he realized that if he was going to get out of prison, he had to basically live out a conversion narrative. He had to show that he was educating himself, changing himself, becoming a better person, right? So it was this performance of himself living out a conversion narrative. Now, the thing is that he's doing this for the parole board, because California at the time had what was called the indeterminate sentence, which meant that they could sentence you from, you know, 1 year to life, and then they could decide, depending on how well you've changed, right, how well you've rehabilitated or converted, they could then decide when you were able to be released. So his sentence was 5 years to life, right? So basically, he realized that if he didn't start basically performing a conversion narrative in his life, going to the library every day, reading books and so on, and being a penitent prisoner, that he was never going to get out of jail. So there you have an example of somebody who's having to not only, you know, write but live out this kind of narrative. Otherwise, he's just never going to get out of prison.
Just listening to Jasper Wood play Henri Vuitton's rendition of Yankee Doodle. Jasper Wood is an assistant professor of violin at the UBC School of Music, who has established himself as one of Canada's top violinists. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. This Friday, November the 21st, the UBC School of Music presents Canada Music Week from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Recital Hall in the Music Building. Piano students of Corey Haum present works by Canadian and international composers. And as well, this Friday, November the 21st, UBC is hosting a panel titled The Forgotten War Against Chinese North Americans from 8 to 9 p.m. at St. John's College Social Lounge. Guest speakers include Dr. Jean Falzer from the University of Delaware, who is the author of the award-winning book Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, and as well as Dr. Patricia Roy from the University of Victoria, who is author of A White Man's Province, British Columbia Politicians and Chinese and Japanese Immigrants from 1858 to 1914. Stay tuned now for Wiener's Barbecue with host Daryl Wiener. We would love to hear your comments and feedback of the show. Please email us at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I'm Farah Khan. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
If you want to look good and not be bummy, yo, you better give me that money.
CITR's third annual fund drive is on now. Call 604 UBC Unit right now to show your support for campus community radio.